This is an interview of Mr. Elias Bonilla, taken at his home at 730B North Wrestler in El Paso, Texas, on Wednesday morning, April the 2nd, 2003. The interviewer is Richard Baquera, and this is for the Bracero Oral History Project. So, Elias, if you will, please first tell me your name.
Elias Bonilla.
And your birthday?
1st of April, 1934.
Oh, so yesterday was your birthday.
69 years young.
Wow, right. So happy one day late birthday. And where were you born?
I was born in Tornillo, Texas, in the El Paso County, down the Lower Valley, about 50 miles from here.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, were they, how long had they been there?
My father and his family migrated from Chihuahua in 1910, in March of 1910. And they had lived in Fabens and in Tornillo for all that time. And my dad grew up in the valley, and he became a store manager, storekeeper as he called it. And my mother and her folks were originally from Coahuila. They had come over much later, and then my mother and father met as young people in the little town of Tornillo, and they married, and of course I was the eldest child.
You
of
are
five.
Mm-hmm. So you have four other?
I have four others.
Brothers and sisters?
He has two brothers, one deceased, and two sisters.
I mm-hmm. see. And your father was, he was always a storekeeper, is that what he... Do you remember?
My father, as a young man, was the leader. That is to say, he represented the family. He represented my grandfather's construction business, and he was the one who dealt with the clients and was the fellow that they went to everything that needed to be done. And he had learned to speak English quite well, and they built a store for a fellow named Mart Silverman, and he took a liking to my dad, having worked with him for months while they were constructing the store, and so he offered him the job of a senior clerk, and later dad became manager of the store for the Silvermans.
That was down there
in Tornillo.
In Tornillo.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember about how many people there were in Tornillo at the time?
Oh, it's an unincorporated little village, hamlet, really. It grew up around the water tower, as so many of these little towns in West Texas did, alongside the railroad. And there must have been about maybe 200, 250 people at most.
But it's mostly like for the farms in the area, right?
Absolutely. That is. It's a cotton farming community, and they also had a oil mill, and they had a cotton seed plant, and of course the oil mill was part of it, and a gin. So that's what kept, that was the economy of the town.
Of the town.
Mm-hmm.
Especially I would assume then in the fall, when all the cotton is being, was it pretty much just all cotton?
At the time, since the construction of the Elephant Butte Dam, which was done somewhere in about the late, about the early teens, about 1912, 1915, the purpose of it was to control the water coming down from the Rio Grande, and it would come through in a flood stage in July, August, and generally just spread throughout the valley, changing the course of the river, causing a lot of havoc. So in order to become more organized agriculturally, they had to tame the river. Both on the Mexican side and on the American side, they had the same problem. And it was very rich bottom land. Unfortunately, the water was not, didn't come in on schedule. Sometimes it was late, sometimes it came in early, but it did come in and just generally flood the fields. So arrangements were made with the government to build Elephant Butte and then turned over to a water improvement district. And there was some interesting things that went on. My grandfather and my father helping him along with his other brothers, my father's brothers, they helped my grandfather use a steel fresno, and he would hire out at $10 an acre to what they call in Spanish desmontar. These would be to smooth out the hillocks and small mounds of earth,
the brush and so on,
and leave it ready for the final grading for the cotton farmer. So for $10 an acre, my grandfather would take two mules and the Fresno, the steel Fresno, and then the children, including my father, they would gather up all the mesquite brush, and that would be piled up in one corner of the acreage. And at the end of the week on Friday, my father would take the two mules and the wooden buggy they had, the wagon, and they would pile up all of the collected mesquite brush and bring it into El Paso, which would have been a minimum of 35 miles from Tornillo into Isleta. And at the time, it was called the Alameda, which of course was Highway 80, our first interstate.
Right.
And the trees grew up over on both sides of the Alameda, which was nothing more than a two-lane macadam with a stripe down the center. And the trees grew up, they were huge cottonwoods, and they met in the center, forming a canopy all the way from Tornillo into Isleta.
Really, that far?
And it was, of course, it's a messy tree. It litters, and every night, by the end of the day and at night, pieces of branches and brush and so on would fall onto the roadway. And the utility companies, I'm talking about the telephone company and the electric company, would send crews out to clean the roadway all the way down, pick it up so that people could safely travel on it. And of course, people were still using it with a combination of automobiles, traffic, some truck, and then of course the wagons, like my dad would take. And it was paralleled, the Alameda was paralleled by the railroad track. So you had the railroads probably 50 yards away, and then you had the canopies, and then you had the Alameda itself in the center of the canopies. And my dad would take all day, he told me, to drive, to take his mules with that wagon full of firewood, and take it into his route. He had a regular route in his letter, and he would take it and he would sell it, or rather trade it, to bakeries. There were a lot of bakeries at the time. And he would also trade it to store owners, and he would trade for groceries. Mm. So by the end of the day, Saturday evening, my dad would have gotten rid of all the wood, and he had a wagon full of groceries. And he would spend the night here, and then sleeping on the wagon. And then in the morning, he'd hitch him up, and he would drive back Sunday back home. So they had a week's worth of groceries that they had negotiated, traded, bartered for the firewood. Mm-hmm. So that was a part of the profit that the family got in the family business of desmontar. And of course, at the time, there wasn't that much land leveled in El Paso County, certainly not in the lower valley. The upper valley was an entirely different situation. Over here you had stagnant water in the upper valley, and that had to be done in another manner. But down in the lower valley, it was done by those harrows, steel Fresnos.
In other words, these were the first people to, they were basically starting the agriculture down there. There hadn't been anything there before?
Well, there had been. What you had at the time was a ready market for alfalfa.
Oh, okay.
Remember that Fort Bliss had a huge cavalry remount there, and then the Mexican cavalry on the other side also had a huge amount of horses. And then there were, of course, the normal farm animals in the lower valley, and so there was a big market for alfalfa. And the average person who lived out in the rural area, outside of the little hamlets, would have truck gardens, and they would grow their own vegetables. So we can say that there was a certain amount of small agricultural plots there.
I see.
But people came here with the idea, came here from places like Alabama and Louisiana and Missouri and those southern states, cotton growing states, and they knew that El Paso could grow cotton. It had been established pretty early, and that's an interesting story, but we don't really have to get into it now. The cotton seed was brought in from outside El Paso, planted, and then of course it was grown. And since there was a ready market with a good price, a world price of cotton, the farmers were good businessmen to begin with, the ones who were successful. Not all of them were, but they grew the cotton, and then they sold it or had it ginned. They started gins again very quickly here to take advantage of it. Good American capitalist.
Sure.
And there was a ready market for the laborer to prepare the land, to level it like my dad and his parents. And there were other people who did the same thing. But my grandfather was a very enterprising man, and he knew how to trade labor for money, and how to trade firewood for groceries, that sort of thing. And he also was an albañil. That is to say, he was a general contractor, a very small general contractor, but he built adobe houses and he built adobe commercial buildings. My father learned to represent him in the negotiations with the owners of these residences to be built and the commercial buildings to be built. And so he told me that he and I got together one time after I had become a contractor, and I took a pencil to all he told me, and I found out that they actually had a margin of profit of 20% on what they did. And at the time, a maestro, this was would be a real first-class adobe placer, a fellow who placed the stuff in the wall,
right,
would get about $1.50 a day. Now the laborers, the ones who made the adobes, let them dry and so on, and also who used the hoe and the water buckets to make the clay adobe plaster and so on. Now they only got about 50 cents a day.
So they made the adobes themselves as well.
They made the adobes themselves right on site, let it dry, and then after they were good and dry in the sun. They weren't baked, they weren't kiln dried or anything, they were just baked in the sun. And then they would use them. And they had two systems of doing it. If it was a residence, they would lay the adobes the long way for the wall. And if it was going to be a commercial building, which required a higher ceiling and more strength, they would turn it on the long way. So that was the way they determined it. And my grandfather, when they started out the building, my dad showed me, he would take the heel of his right foot, and he would make a mark in the dirt, and then he would, at right angles, he would make a second mark, and then he would do it at every corner, and then that was a signal for the laborers to start digging. They dug down maybe about a foot, and then they started putting in rocks that they had collected. So the foundation for these adobe buildings consisted of large rocks and layers of lime mortar.
Right.
That was the foundation. And then after the walls were going to be brought up, they would mix concrete and pour a floor. And then as they came up, they used the old method, which was introduced by the Spanish from the Arabs in Spain, which was to use a rope. And the rope had it was about 20 feet long, and it had knots in it indicating the placement and the width of both windows and doors. So wow. They would lay it on top of the foundation.
Crosswise. Or lengthwise.
Lengthwise. And that would be your mark. That would be your mason's mark, instead of using twine, which they didn't have. And but they made everything work. Mm-hmm. They were good at what they did. And they were very, very efficient and very hardworking. And everything was done on a quota system. Yeah, they paid the guy, my grandfather paid the maestro $1.50 a day. But by God, he had to lay 200 topis a day. And of course, everybody at the end of the day was wiped out.
The lime for the mortar, did they have to buy it, or was it?
They had to buy it. Okay. They had to buy it. And but that was readily available, lime.
I see.
And it isn't like this fancy lime, yellow-colored hydrated stuff we have now. It was just pure lime, you know. And that was also used for food.
For the corn?
For the corn.
Right.
Right. And that gave them good, strong teeth.
Yeah, I guess so.
Look at mine.
Did he ever tell you what was the largest building they constructed? Was it mostly just homes and businesses?
He did both. Most of the adobe houses that they built are still standing in the little town of Tornillo. My dad took me around to all of them and showed them to me. And I took my kids and I showed them to them, and I made them touch the walls and lean into them. And of course, every year, of course, they deteriorate. And the largest building in Tornillo was the oil mill. It was a huge place. And they tore it down here about possibly 10 years ago. And everybody in our family got a little piece of something as a souvenir.
They had constructed that.
And now he also constructed a number of buildings in Fabens. They had lived in Fabens. They had built their own compound, the three brothers, my grandfather and his two brothers. And then they also built some commercial buildings, which are still there. And of course, I have no idea how many residences they built in Tornillo or Cuadrilla or San Elisario or Socorro or any place like that. He was very active in the trade till he died in 1928. My grandfather died in 1928. And my mother and father married in 1933, and soon after that. And he continued working there until during World War II. We left my grandfather's house, which my father had inherited, and we in Tornillo, and we went to live in the Allison place. Dad became, for a while, he was the storekeeper, ran the commissary at the L.R. Allison Farms. It was the largest cotton and cattle company, or cattle farm, in the Lower Valley. It had 1,500 acres. It spanned from Highway 80 to the Mexican border. And then...
In other words, to the river?
Clear to the river. And then it was maybe half a mile wide, something like that. And at the time, it was just... They just again, the pecans had not been introduced yet, so they still had a fairly good market for alfalfa, even though the cavalry was still here in World War II, the early years. But the Mexicans were raising their own alfalfa by then. So the cotton was very useful, very usable, and enjoyed a good world market price for many years. And it was the dominant cotton in the world. They made, you know, denim from it, and they made a number of other things. And they also had very ingeniously used the very fine lint that was left on the cotton seed for a number of things. One was to make explosives, and it was also as one of the constituent parts of making film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, movie film.
Didn't realize that.
Right, acetate. And then, of course, they crushed the seed, and the oil was used to make, of course, a substitute for butter. And then they used everything, including the shell. The shell that was left over from after they thoroughly processed the seed was used as cattle feed. It was very nutritious.
Really?
So they used everything.
Sounds like it.
And there was, of course, not much of a there was always a demand for labor to pick the cotton and to irrigate it and to hoe it and so on. And so up until World War II, it had not been a problem. You had some people who would come over every day from the little towns along the border, on the other side of the border, from Caseta, Guadalupe, San Ignacio, and all those places. And they would come over in the morning, and they would work all day, and then in the evening they would simply walk back across. And that was all pretty well understood. The Border Patrol and the customs people went along with it because the American farmers needed that labor. And there were a lot of native Mexican Americans who did that, but they were always looking for a little better work than that. And so they had to bring in these day laborers, jornaleros, from Mexico to take up the slack.
Do you remember how much they were paid?
Not much. Remember, I was a child then, and I have done quite a bit of research on it, and I remember the stories I was told. I don't have a firm grasp on all of the numbers. Yeah. In World War II, quickly, the Americans took prisoners, and they brought them in to places like El Paso and many other places, I'm sure, and they set up camps. There was one in Favens in particular, and I think they had about 50 people there. I remember seeing it.
Germans, Italians, do you remember?
The first ones were Germans, and after that they brought in more Italians. And the Italians were very amenable. They could almost speak Spanish. You know, it's a very similar language, as you know, Romance language. And they, neither the Germans nor the Italians, who I understand were basically rural people, farmers themselves, but they weren't used to the heat, and they certainly weren't used to stoop labor. And their productivity was pretty low.
Right.
Pretty low. If they picked 100 pounds a day, that was a lot. It was mostly like 35 to 50 pounds. Some did more, some did about that. And so the American farmers were pretty unhappy about it. But all the available Mexican-American labor, including my uncles and even my dad for a short while, they were all drafted and they were gone. They were fighting. And that little town produced dozens of soldiers. Most of them went in the army. And so there was a vacuum here. There was no labor, and there was a huge demand for the cotton products. And you can imagine that for uniforms alone, khaki. And so at the time, and I can't pretend to know exactly how it worked out, but the Mexican movers and shakers over here in Juarez realized that there was a huge market for labor on the American side, and there was a huge surplus of Mexican labor on the other side, and there was no way to get them back and forth because of the immigration laws, which were being strictly enforced after all in security reasons. And the as I recall, the railroads were staffed with Mexican soldiers with bayonets, you know, and they patrolled the passenger cars to prevent escaping prisoners of war, American prisoners of war, from going down into Mexico. So there was a lot of that. You could see that. And I recall we had gone to, Dad had moved the family to California, East Los Angeles, which is another interesting story, but we won't go into that. When we got back in 1949, things had changed here in El Paso.
So you were at the Allison farm then?
Sure, about 1946.
I see. And then you
then we moved to California.
For about 3 years?
About 3 years, and came back.
Came back.
And it didn't turn out to be as exciting and wonderful as we were told. We were told that it was Mexican blue heaven, but it really wasn't.
So you came back to the same place?
Dad maneuvered a new contract with Mr. Allison, and he came back to run instead of going to Tornillo and running the commissary there, the store in the little town, we went to the Allison place and went directly there from California. And Dad took up the duties of it
Let's see, you would have been in about 10 years old?
I was about 14 or 15 years old, somewhere in there. 34 to 44 is 10.
That's right. Yes, I was thinking 39, 34, sure.
Right. Excuse me.
Your schooling, where you went to school?
I graduated from junior high school in Montebello, California. And I graduated from elementary school here in Tornillo. And I started Montebello Senior High School in 1949. And then in the middle of the year, I was uprooted and brought back here. And I finished my high school education in Tornillo. I graduated in 1952. And then I immediately went into the Air Force because I wanted the GI Bill so I could go to college. But when we got back, there had been a change. I don't recall if it was the first year of the Bracero program or not. I'm sure you'll have more information, more accurate information than what I'm giving you about that. But I recall that Dad would ask me if I wanted to help receive the workers as they were coming from Rio Vista.
Can I ask you though, first of all, excuse me?
Yes.
The commissary itself, it was a building on the Allison farm
that was. Yes, it was.
Could you just kind of describe it? What kind of.
Sure.
What did you sell?
Sure.
What was your.
Okay.
You know, your father ran it, but was there like a certain profit that he made? I'm just curious.
Okay.
About
The Allison place was a self sufficient. Almost hacienda, and people lived on the place, managers and so on, and most of the senior managers were Anglo. They had their own machine shop and a mechanical shop, and then there was a manager who ran who was the administrator, and he did the bookkeeping, and Dad ran the store, and then they had their own blacksmith shop where they did a great deal of work in addition to the machine shop. And they had their own blacksmith guy there with his own anvil and a huge hearth, and bang, 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 all day long. I can still hear it today. A wonderful memory. And then there were the people who handled the livestock. They had always had a certain amount of beef cattle on the place, and later they introduced sheep, trying to raise sheep. That didn't work out too well. But they always had cattle, and of course they had a herd of horses. And at one time, in one summer, I worked as a cowboy and learned to ride, you know, and work the cattle and so on. And so they had a caballerango, which, as you know, is the root word for the American cowboy word wrangler. Caballerango, wrangler. And he was the guy who took care of all the horses, took care of all the tack, and kept the herd in good, the horse herd in good repair. And they used them, of course, to move the cattle from one pasture to another. And because when they were through raising a crop of alfalfa, which was harvested up till about maybe the fourth cutting, the fifth cutting, then they would bring in the cattle and let them graze on it. But they had to keep them moving because alfalfa has a tendency to bloat, create gas mm-hmm. in the cattle. So they had to keep them moving. That was what we did as kids. So anyway, the big product, of course, was cotton. Mr. Allison was an investor, and he had purchased that land by combining three smaller farms. He bought them and combined them all under the L.R. Allison. And the way he worked, he had an interest in a construction company in New Mexico, Allison Haney, and they were the largest road contractors in New Mexico. And he was politically very well connected with the senators from New Mexico, and also he was very well connected with the state representatives and senators from El Paso to Austin. And he also invested in oil and gas leases. He did that. And he was a friend of Conrad Hilton. All these people were originally from New Mexico, so they all knew each other. And he kept a place at the Hilton Hotel in downtown El Paso. He always kept the penthouse. He kept it rented, and that was one of his places where he stayed. And he also had an apartment in a New York City hotel, because he often went there. And he bought the land and built, or caused to be built, this large hacienda building as a residence. And he was there with his daughter, Frances Allison, a wonderful woman. I'll go into that a little later. And but he was traveling a lot, so he had professional managers in charge of what he did. And whenever he was in residence, well, of course, things revolved around what he needed done. But for the most part, he was an absentee owner. But he kept track of everything. he really did. He was quite a businessman. He also had been involved in the creation of one of the dams in New Mexico. Had been a partner in that, and had made a ton of money during the war, because if you'll remember, they needed electricity, they needed the dams built, and so the government gave cost-plus contracts. Hmm. And it was a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week construction job. They poured concrete 24 hours a day to build those dams. So I forget which dam he was involved in, but he got one. Anyway, the man was very busy, and he also found time to start the Sunland Park racetrack.
Oh, so we had horses as well.
Horses. he could see the value of having horse racing down here, and since he had the politicians with him and so on, he was able to get that done. But in order to do it, he needed water and he needed wells. And of course, when the people heard about his plans, well, all hell broke loose in El Paso. All of the Protestant churches, and I don't think the Catholics got too involved in it, but they thought it was just terrible that gambling was being brought in so close to us. And so they led a drive to stop the drilling of the water wells so that there would be no casino, no racetrack, no gambling. He was able to prevail and get the wells sunk and they started the thing. So you can see he was very
it sounds like it.
Anyway, he was also involved very much, of course, it was in his interest, as far as the labor is concerned, to have some input into making sure that the Bracero program was a reality. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Antonio Bermudez in Juarez who came up with the idea of a Bracero program, brazo, of course, meaning strong arm, where they would contract, every farmer would contract, it was all worked out legally, into Rio Vista, and that would become, I'm sure you've already had information on that, that would become the place, the reception center, for all of the qualified men from all over Mexico. And then as each farmer neared his crop need for labor, then he would contract for so many, and they would send them out in buses, usually at night, and because it was cooler then and so on. And so there I take up again my story of Dad asked me to go help him, and we got up and we went over there about 10 o'clock at night, you know. And Dad opened up the warehouse, which was across the street from the commissary. There was a huge, huge area, open area, between the corrals, the dairy cattle, the horse herd, the warehouse, storage, and the buildings, the administrative building with the connected store next to it and warehouse for this for the commissary, and then a great number of other outbuildings. So they had a terrific infrastructure. It was all pretty well planned, and they all had metal roofs on them, aluminum roofs, which were later painted silver. And but all of the walls, the plaster walls on the adobe buildings, were all white, and the trim was painted a royal blue, dark blue, and everything on the place was the same color except his hacienda. And we had they had housing for the all of the managers, and it was according to tenure which house you got. Some were just starter houses, and some were better, and some were much better. And according to your pecking order, you got a house.
Right.
Dad usually got us an upgrade every year, you know. And we finally wound up living right behind the store. It was a very nice place. And
the store then was there basically to provide for the needs of the workers who were there
for
the whole place.
The whole place. Yeah.
So that you wouldn't have to go into Tornillo or anywhere else, whatever you needed, supplies, food, anything was there.
It was all there, and they would also take charge of ordering custom things, whatever they really needed, since Dad had the contacts with all these vendors who would come in. It was a mile, three quarters of a mile, from Highway 80 to the front of the store, and it was a two-lane gravel road with trees on both sides. And they would come in all day long, all the vendors. They would bring in bread, they would bring in milk, they would bring in groceries, and they would bring in all kinds of staples, and on and on and on, and salesmen, you know, specialty salesmen. So anything that was needed from El Paso or elsewhere was ordered through the store, and Dad took care of that.
About how many workers do you suppose were on the farm?
The men who lived on the place in Mexico, they're called peones acasillados. Peones acasillados. These are laborers who were given free rent. And then you have the peones de día, jornaleros, who would come in during the day, but they left at night, in the evening. So there was probably, I would say, year-round, there were probably maybe 50 people, including the families and the managers, people like Dad and his family, and then all of the others, the people who were in charge of the agricultural group.
Must have been a good-sized commissary then.
It was, and there was a big turnover of items, but it was the big one was yet to come. Dad had a butcher shop at one end of the store with a walk-in freezer, and then the rest of it was taken up with canned goods along one side, and across the back were all the dry goods. And then there were other things on the serving counter where you would have candies and things like that. And it was a concrete floor. And it was, by the time you had stacks of soda, for example, which were brought in and placed one on top of the other all the way up to the ceiling, it was kind of tight in there. It really was. And so Dad would hire clerks. Dad put me to work behind a counter at the age of, I think I was 8 years old.
Oh,
that's
really?
That's when I got my Social Security card, 1943, I think. Anyway, Dad taught me how to wait on people and all that. And he had one little mechanical adding machine. You pushed on it and you pulled the thing.
And a lever.
And you, and Dad wouldn't let me use it. He told me not to use it. And I said, well, what do you have it here for? He says, look, he says, you learn to do your adding with a pencil and all. Just learn to do the addition. Now, if you want to check your addition on the bill for accuracy, then you can use the machine. Well, by the time you got through and you were busy, you didn't have time to work the little machine. You did it all by pencil. And this is the way Dad taught me to do. Today, I find myself taking notes or doing what I need to do with a number two pencil and a yellow.
In the same way.
And he was right in a way, because I've seen places where when the electricity goes off and everybody's used to using adding machines and what have you, and the lights go off, they're helpless. They cannot do anything. But anyway, Dad would hire clerks and train them as he needed them. When the braceros came in, there was an explosion of work of everything. They brought in more tractors. They repaired them. And they had all kinds of equipment to begin with. And they even used surplus army equipment. They had a tank that they had remodeled.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A tank.
A tank.
What were they going to use it
They used it to pull these huge plows, steel plows.
Oh, I see.
At one time or another, you do have to go deep and turn the dirt over.
Right.
And as you understand, cotton depletes the soil with nitrogen and so on. So they had to put in alfalfa for a couple of years to replenish the soil and then go back to the cotton. But in order to get all the root system of the alfalfa, which is very extensive and very hard, they had to use very, very deep plowing. So they had to have caterpillars for that, but they also had the tank.
A tank.
You couldn't just get anything you wanted you usually bought things used and then you repaired them if you had a good mechanic. So they were always cannibalizing parts and so on, creating new ones, welding new ones and all. A busy, busy place.
Sounds like.
Some of my earliest memories are going over and listening in the summers and listening to and talking to the guy at the blacksmith shop while he was doing all of the work, sharpening and resharpening the tools for the various machines.
Do you remember his name?
No, I don't. He lived in Caseta. Oh, and he had a family over. He was an older guy, but he was very stout, a lifetime of you know. And he came back and forth. When he retired, well, he just left, and they brought in some people with new automatic machines. Mm. No more hand, you know. But I still remember the ding, ding, you know. And they would talk to me, and I had a run of the place. You know, everybody knew me. And they were real good to me, all those kids. And I had learned to get along with laborers and so on. My mother had taken us in the summers down to Mexico, down to Coahuila, to a little town outside Torreon. And my grandfather and grandmother lived there. That's where she had been born. So she would take us kids, the three of us, three of them were born later, and we would jump on the train and we would go down as soon as school let out in El Paso County. We would go on the train and go down about a 2-day trip down to Coahuila, down through all those towns. It was an exciting adventure for a kid, I'm telling you. And we had to sleep, of course. You didn't have first class accommodations. You had second, and then you had third. And third was where all the chickens and pigs were, and second, at least you had a place to sit. And there was no dining facilities, so you bought food at every stop. And there was a lot of stops. People would come up and thrust cups of coffee and milk at you and gorditas and tamales and whatever you wanted to eat.
Right.
And then no one gave any thought about sanitary facilities or food inspectors or anything. You just grabbed what you could, paid for it, and ate. And then there would be musicians. I remember one guy was a blind guy, and he was good on the guitar, and his son would bring him aboard, you know, and the guy would sing, and people would take pity, and he had a melodic voice, and he always sang these real tear jerkers, you know, Mexican songs,
what you could call drinking songs.
Drinking songs, right? And of course, there were always people on the way down. Of course, there was the ever present Mexican soldiers with their guns and all, and the Mexican National Railroads bought a lot of equipment from the Americans. When the Americans came out with diesel electrics, they got rid of all of their steams, and all the steam stuff went down south, you know. And in Mexico did the same thing. When they got ready to buy other equipment, they would take theirs, and they would sell it to Guatemala, Honduras, or whatever. Whatever we do to the Mexicans on this border here, they do to
somebody
people
else.
Somebody else down there.
Lower on the pecking order.
Yes, sir. I mean, it's done that way. And I remember sometimes that we would be going down. One of my memories was that going down a steep hill, going down into
Gomez Palacio,
and we were coming down Lickety Split. And all of a sudden, I was the only guy awake in the whole little, in that particular train or car, and I could see the lights from the other car getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and I looked, and then I realized we had pulled apart.
Oh no!
And so I woke everybody up. I said, "Hey, we're gonna," be, you know, and everybody got up in an uproar, you know. Well. The engineer, this wasn't the first time it had happened, he just simply slowed down, and eventually we caught up with him, and off we went again. And then I remember another time we had to stop because they had to do some mechanical repair on this one of the engines. So out in the middle of the desert, God knows where, everybody started getting out and going behind a bush and relieving themselves, you know. And then all of a sudden, the toot, 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 let's go, let's get out of here. And you could see people jumping behind bushes and running toward the train. Anyway, it was for a real adventure for a little kid.
It sounds like it.
Anyway, of course, I went to school in Mexico in the summers. And then when I got back, I was put back into the elementary school here. And I recall that the very first summer I went down there, I was put in the second grade. They didn't know what to do with me. And I didn't know, my Spanish wasn't that good. But they decided, as a favor to my grandfather, everybody knew there, had his little store there, they put me in, and my sister and my brother, and they put them in the first grade, and they put me in the second grade. And so I learned, I went to the Mexican school, which it turned out later, I found out that it was based on the European system. Mm. And, you know, the first six grades, and I mean, right. You get algebra and everything to the sixth grade, and then that's it. From there on, either you go to college, or you go to a trade school, or you go to work, you know.
Right.
Anyway, it was very interesting, and I learned to, of course, salute the flag and to say the poems, the national poems, are very strong on that down there. And also I learned the culture, how things are done, you know, between, and they would be, you know, maybe two grades, three grades in the same room. And the boys would flirt with the girls, and this was not allowed. And the professor and the professora, boy, they were law. They were the law, and they had the right, to exercise corporal punishment. If somebody got out of line, they'd slap the hell out of them. You know.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, both boys and girls, and that was it. That was the end of it. Nobody, you know, complained, or there were no letters to the editor, and nobody sued the principal of the school or that.
No bringing in the parents.
El profesor, nothing. The profesor was the law. And so they have a great deal of respect for an educated person down there. Anyway, a lot of adventures in those summers that we went down there. But I had learned to meet and talk to my grandfather. Was very, very good about it. He also taught me behind the counter to wait on people. But he did it in Spanish, and he gave me a great deal of education about people in general. And I spent many a happy hour at his elbow listening to him tell me about people in the little town and so on. So I had that advantage. And so my Spanish increased, my understanding of it. And the first summer went that way, and then we came back in the fall, and I marched up to Tornillo School to go into second grade, and I sat down, and all of a sudden I realized I didn't understand. I had forgotten my English during the summer. It was astounding, hair-raising to me. I didn't understand them, but these were my friends. I knew them, and I knew they were trying to tell me something and this and the other, but I couldn't understand them. Do you know what the sound of English sounds like to someone who doesn't speak English?
No, I've never thought of it from that end.
Sounds like the hissing of geese. There are so many sharp S sounds in the English language. You can't believe, how on earth are you going to learn to speak a language with so many psss, sss, it's so distracting. But soon, in a couple of weeks, it came back to me. And I went on my merry way.
It's amazing that you would forget it.
Yes.
After
we did. Well, it happened.
It just, I guess, reflects more on the immersion, the total immersion you were put into over there with this, in the Mexican school. So how old were you when you first started working at the commissary with your dad? Working with the braceros, maybe?
Dealing with the braceros, I was about 15 years old, in 1949. And they were brought in, as I explained to you. And the way it worked, they would bring in a busload. Let's say there were 20 people, 30 people. and they would all come down off the bus, and the bus would drive off. They were going to go pick up other people and take them elsewhere. And there would be a list of names. And the administrator was there with his list, and then he would talk to Dad, and Dad would say, okay, you guys make a cuadrilla, four of you are going to live in one room. So they would kind of, you know, select each other, and they would stand off and be a cuadrilla, be four of them. Each cuadrilla then would receive their allotment. So this was all worked out by the Mexican government.
So you all didn't really have a choice as to what?
No, because the Americans had agreed to furnish them everything and pay them so much and also provide a certain amount of medical attention to them and so on. It was all. And remember, they were only going to be there for a certain number of months. It was not a permanent situation. So then Dad would have a couple of the guys, his clerks, help him. And each cuadrilla then would receive their common utensils. Now, in each room, which was about maybe 10 by maybe 14, something like that, and it had one door and one window. And there they had the cuadra, and it was a huge rectangle with an open area in the center. It was already built, it was already there. This was quarters
for the braceros,
quarters for semi-permanent workers, what have you. But they were not houses. The houses were separate. You
know. Right.
Anyway, there was one light bulb, about a 75 or 100 watt bulb. I don't think it was 100, more like a 60 or 75, in the middle of the room. And in the middle of the room was one table. And there were four chairs. And then there were four cots, army cots, with the, you know, the springs.
Those old style?
The old style.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there would be four men to a room. And that's what they would have. Now, each one then received their utensils. But to continue with the common utensils, they would get one very large soup spoon. And this was blue and white enameled metalware. That's what they got. It was new. And it had this peculiar polka dot effect, the white coming through the blue.
Right.
You know. Perfectly good. There was nothing wrong with it. It was army issue. Anyway, they got, each man got a kind of like a soup platter, which was a large dish, but it was, you know,
kind of deep,
and they could eat soup out of it and whatever they wanted to. So each one got that, and they each one got a cup, and of course they also got a large bowl so they could wash dishes in it, and they also got a two burner kerosene stove about this high, about this big.
And what's that, about 2 feet by 1 foot less, something like that?
Similar, yeah, that would be good. And then each one of them had, of course, about a half-gallon capacity glass fuel tank.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that. And then personal utensils furnished. They each got a fork, a knife, and a spoon, a small spoon. That was it now. That was issued to them, and that was chrome-plated metal of some kind.
Was there any kind of pots, pans, any kind of cooking, anything that they could cook on in? Do you remember?
They could make, they had, yeah, you're right, there was a frying pan.
Oh, okay.
I don't think each one got a frying pan. I think there was a common frying pan, but it may have been two. And they cooked their own food, except that there would be some of the people who lived on the place, whose wives and children lived there, they would have what they call casas de borde. This would be a person that you would sign up with, and you would be given hot meals. And it would cost so much a day, maybe a dollar and a half or something in that order. And they would make you three meals a day. They would make you a morning breakfast and give you a lunch so you could take it with you in a bag, paper bag, and at night they could have the cena. And they cooked up a storm and they ladled it out to these guys. And a lot of the men, just when they started making money, that was luxury to them. They didn't want to do that. So anyway,
so they'd rather do their own cooking.
They would for a while until they got tired of it, because they were used to having their women folk do all their cooking. And here it was, they had to cook, make a lunch, and then at night they would come home dog tired, and then they
cook
would
again,
have to cook
and
again,
clean the dishes, and
eat the whole schmear. So a lot of them just gave up and they said, okay, I'll just work harder and pay a dollar and a half a day. And later on the price went up, of course, the food prices went up. Anyway, then after that, they immediately were given a ficha. And the ficha was a brass disc with a number on it, with black enameled figures on it. And that was their open credit. They could buy food at the commissary against future earnings. And whatever they owed, they had a system where they would present them. We didn't keep up with their names, although we after a while we learned their names and we really got to know them. And we would get the, we would take their order, they would give the ficha, and we'd take the number down. That was all important, was the number. Give them back their ficha, and then they would tell us, quiero una caja de pan. I want a loaf of white bread. They had never seen white bread till they got here. But boy, did they learn to like it.
They did.
Yeah, they learned to like it. It was white and rich flour bread. Worst thing you can eat, but, you know, there it was. Back then, we didn't have all this knowledge about what was good and what wasn't. And they would tie a knot on it so air wouldn't get in there and it would last for a while. And then some of them would buy together. Say, bueno, pues tú compra esto, yo compro el otro, and so on. And so they quickly, you know, found out how to buy and what to do. And then they would buy metal, they would buy cans of food. And they liked to buy the prepared beans. They liked to. Because they didn't really know how to cook beans properly. And it took forever. And they didn't want to be there stirring. Sure. And so there is no, I guess there is a cultural bias against men cooking in Mexico. Some have to, of course. But most of the time, this is trabajo de mujeres, you know. And they never really learn. They certainly don't appreciate it. So this was, you know, this is where the commissary came in.
Did they get, like, I'm sure they did, but you didn't mention it, like a blanket, a pillow?
I'm sorry.
Like that?
They got a pillow, army, and they also got a bedroll.
Okay.
And then they got, each got a army blanket, olive blanket.
Old style blanket.
That pretty much completes the issue that each man got.
How about any, like, food, any, to just to get them started, any kind of food? No.
Dad simply opened up the commissary.
The commissary.
Now, they had been fed at Rio Vista. They had evenings, supper. So the only thing they had to prepare for was in the next morning, because they went to work right away. So then they would have to make breakfast, and they would have to also make a lunch.
Make a lunch.
And the first few days was hectic for them, because it was all new to them. They had never done it before, and they would forget. They would forget they had to buy this and buy that, and there was no refrigeration, so the food spoiled. I mean, you ate it. You cooked it. You ate it because it was spoiled. And so the water, there was two water taps in the center of the open area, and there, that worked as everything. That's where they threw out their dishwater and everything else. And they also got the water for drinking and the water for cooking and for bathing. They would take the water inside. They would buy a bucket from the store.
Really, and that's what they would...
And they would you know, take a bath. And they used the usual system that rural people have used forever. I mean, they bathe on Saturday night. That's it. And then during the week, they couldn't afford to buy razor blades. It was too expensive. La hoja. They would shave once a week. And then they would be ready for Sunday. There's no church facilities, nowhere to go, but still this was the custom, the costumbre. And then they would put on their nice clothes and they would spend all day Sunday in the cuadra, and they would play card games and they would play baseball, and they would just sit and talk and visit and write letters and all that. And they would walk, take long walks to the river and back. They knew they couldn't get out of there because that would void their contract, and boom, they'd send them right back. And this was good work, good money. All they had to do was focus and concentrate on producing, and they could make money. The men, as time went on, I recall that at the peak of the cotton picking season, there would be a total of some 600 at the Allison place.
Really?
That's men working there. A lot of them, since there was no more housing available, the quarter was completely full up, they would come in. They would, by that time, a lot of them were quartered in caseta, and they would have a car somehow or other, and they would drive over in the morning. And these were the guys who were there, jornaleros. All legal. They all had their papers, and they were checked at the Fabens Bridge, for example, and they would come across and present their cars, and the guys knew where they were going, and they were looking for them at night. You come back tonight. And it worked out pretty well, smooth. But there would be that many. But remember, the picking was over, you know, 30 to 60 days. I mean, boom, boom, it was done.
Cotton pick, yes.
And they had a train of these cotton wagons where they would pour the cotton in.
Right.
And they would have a whole system of people who weighed the cotton for them and gave and gave them a slip of the amount of cotton that the machine said they had picked up, the scales. And they were paid so much, I think it was a penny and a half or something like that, per pound. And at the end of the week, they would tally up everything that they had picked, and then they would calculate. Somebody in the office, I think Eleanor Martin. Before that, the guy she worked for was Seibert, who was the administrator. They would calculate it, and each man got a little brown envelope with his number on it and his name, and in it they would put in the copies of his receipts that were kept showing what he had bought. And that was stuffed in there. And then they would take the money that he owed to the store and turn it over to the administrator's fund. And then what was left over, his net, they would stuff into that. And that was his money. Clear of all debt.
All his cash, right?
All cash. All cash. They had to go to Fabens and pick up the money and bring it in. And I suppose it was $1,000. I never knew. Anyway, at payday, they had a little window, and everybody would just come right on up, and they would give their feature. They would show it, and they would be given their thing, and then they would look at it and study it, and then they would go and tell Dad, "Oiga, usted me cobró tanto," you know, this, that, and the other. And Dad would make an adjustment, or he'd tell him, "Get out of here." Don't try to con me. And they would buy things for themselves once they started getting money in, like pocket knives. And they all liked to carry these pocket watches. Oh, they all like pocket watches. And then they would buy themselves straw hats for Sunday wear. And then they would buy cowboy clothes, norteño, they call it. The guys from the northern states, Sonora, Chihuahua, Coahuila, Tamaulipas, you know, places like that, they would dress norteño. And we could tell by their dress where they were from after you get to know them. And the guys from the sureños, the guys who were from the south, were always muy indiados. They were very dark and very Indian features, and they always dressed in white. White shirt, white pants. The other men call them guardapelos because they had narrow legs, you know.
Oh, and then the trousers.
And then they would also wear huaraches. They didn't wear shoes, they wore huaraches.
All the time?
All the time. That was it. Wow. And so they worked and dressed and everything in those same huaraches, and then they would wash out their white clothes because that's what they wore in the southern part of Mexico. It was very humid.
Sure.
And but the guys who were from the more rural, more urban areas dressed differently. And all the guys along the border from Chihuahua and all that, they always wore these fancy norteño clothes. They wore these fancy belts. And the ones that could afford it would buy boots. Most of them didn't, but they would buy boots. And then they would wear dark, you know, Levi's and cowboy shirts. The louder, the better. And a nice hat.
It's interesting, they wouldn't, at first they wouldn't pay for someone to cook for them, but then later, you know, they're buying these, what you would consider maybe expensive clothes that
yes.
they would have, you would think they would want to save the money for take home.
Richard,
with
it was, it evolved. What they did, their customs evolved. According to them, as personalities, and also accordingly, they were making more money. They were sending money home. Don't get me wrong, they did it. That was their purpose for being there. But they also, you want me to stop? Or you
no, that's okay. I'm okay. Almost at the end of this tape.
All right.
Is the problem.
How long is that?
I think it's 74 and we're at 72.
Oh, great.
I can go ahead and stop it if you want.
No. Anyway,
get the new tape in.
Remember that this went on for years. So what happened was that you had certain men, a lot of them, became almost permanent braceros at the places where they had started. They really did. And a lot of them simply transferred their place of residence from down in the interior to these towns over here, you know, Zaragoza, San Ignacio, and so on in there. And so what they would do, they would become the daily jornaleros, or even if they didn't, they would go home on the weekends. But they were making money. They had learned how to work the system and work hard. And so they had money left over to buy. Now they would also buy for their children. And Dad always had, you know, clothing there, and also American underwear for the women, brassieres and panties and all that. And then also cotton underwear for the men, and khaki shirts, khaki pants, and the sombreros. And the guys from the interior would wear straw hats, all right, but they had a peculiar cultural habit. They would have a little string in the back with a little flower or a little feather hanging from the back.
Of the hat?
Of the hat.
Of the hat.
And that way you could tell where he was from. Este camarada viene de Zacatecas, mira. And you could tell by their walk, their confidence. You could tell by their clothing, mostly. And you could tell by their accent where they were from. And we learned a lot. I did. Learned a lot from them. And I grew to like them very much. And I respected there was a nobility about their work. They were proud of what they did. Very masculine. And they were not at all what you would think. Or at least we got the clean cut group up here. They weren't drunks, they weren't any of that, or fighters or anything like that. They were pretty clean cut, mature men, family men who knew they couldn't make a good living for their families over there, but they could over here.
Over here.
And so you had that. Also, you had some of them who applied for and became permanent visa green card residents. And now that's an interesting story, because a number of them brought their families over, or brought their young wives over, and they had children over here as American citizens. And the kids went through school there in Tornillo and all, and graduated from high school, and several of them went to college. And women, the girls and the men, and became very productive citizens and had good professional jobs. You find that up and down. The family took root.
Right. Yeah. Sounds like what you're describing is you believe that it was very much of a success for overall, because the farmers here needed the workers came over, and by and large it seems like they succeeded maybe more than they ever hoped they would if some were able to stay here.
Yes, you're right.
Do you think so?
However, what really happened, the other side of the story is that as soon as they could, they got out of here. This was a springboard to the interior.
Oh, I see.
They knew they could go to Kansas City. They knew they could go to Chicago. They could go to Denver. They could work in the mines in Arizona. They could work, for example, in the places, the meat cutting places in Iowa.
This would be as braceros or as illegals?
Oh. As legal green card.
Oh, okay.
You see? So, yeah, they would come in and they would pay their dues. It took a while. It took a while to get that green card. It wasn't done in a day. But then they took the kids and they were gone. And the kids who stayed there went to school. But as soon as they could, they got out of here. They went to college elsewhere. And they quickly went to work in Dallas and Houston and Austin and places like that. And then they would send for their mother and father. And over there, they all lived together, following the old tradition. And they would have a car or two cars or three cars. And they would buy a house. And they would buy furniture. And by God, they would start all over again. But, you know, it's like the old story. Three generations. It takes three generations to make an American citizen. The third one, the grandchild, doesn't speak Spanish or Polish or anything else. He's an American. And the middle people, what we would call the immigrant generation, they're in between. And then, of course, the original group that came over, you know, the grandparents.
Yeah, that would be the... Let me start. This is the end of the first part. This is the second part of the interview with Elias Bonilla. And you were telling me about how they were, many of them were able to successfully use the system to, once they got their green card, to leave and to go to many different places. I wanted to go back. There's a couple of questions.
All right.
How long was their work day? You mentioned how they got paid, but like their typical work day or work week.
Well, it was certainly longer than 40 hours.
Yeah.
Remember, they were being paid as contract labor. There's no salaries involved. The only salaried people were people like my dad and other managers.
Right.
But that was different. They were there all year round, and they worked 6 days a week. But the laborers themselves worked 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. They were off Sunday. And time was when they started in the morning, maybe say early, because in the summer when it was very hot, they would start real early when you could still just barely see daylight. Say they would start around 5 o'clock in the morning, and then they would work until it became unbearably hot, or they reached the end of Los Surcos, you know, they had to
right.
go to another
rows,
another field.
Yeah.
And they could stop pretty much when they wanted to, but they'd have to walk all the way back. There would be no transportation for them. But yet, you know, they were very, very serious and industrious. While there was daylight and there was work to be done, they did it because this is what they were here for, to make money.
Right.
And so there was never any question about their motivation. They very quietly planned what they were going to do for themselves and what they would do in accumulating money. Some of them, for example, accumulated enough money. I remember a couple of guys in particular, they brought their families into Caseta, and they then opened a little store.
Oh.
Yes.
They learned from your father.
That's right. They opened, right. It was one guy, Francisco something or other. We call him Pancho Pistolas. He was a real character and hard worker. And he had his family over here, brought them up from, I think, from the interior. And they set up a little store, and he would buy things from Dad and take him across and resell them over there. Because not everybody could come across. Remember, the gates had slammed shut World War II and afterwards. And so you didn't have that much free flow. The only people who come over were people who had a visa, you know, or who had a one-day permit, shopping permit. But not everybody had a car. So people on the other side were limited in their ability to come over and buy things. So they were kind of prey for people who brought the stuff over there and sold it to them on credit. Credit. Remember that. Anyway, what you had was, I always thought, and I admired them, and I saw that they were people who wanted to better themselves and who were very crafty, very patient, and who saw opportunities for themselves and who were quite willing to sacrifice years of hard work in order to achieve certain goals for themselves and their family, to better la familia. And they not only took advantage of American educational opportunities for their children, but they also took advantage, you know, as we mentioned earlier, that once they got that green card, there was a ticket to anywhere they wanted to go in the United States. And there was absolutely no problem in going to work anywhere else in the United States. Here in this part of the country, people tend to follow the 106th, what is that, the meridian. They go straight up. And then from there, they go over to Iowa or Nebraska or whatever.
Go up like to Denver.
Denver, straight up. They take the railroad, for example, or they take Greyhound bus. In California, that was an entirely different matter. People from Arizona, that they go up and they have their own states that they follow, and they also do a lot of work in the mines over there, which is not necessarily true over here. Here, these people are agricultural workers,
right.
Best in the world, very, very good. And then on the East Coast, I mean the West Coast, you have very hard-working people, for example, from the state of Jalisco, absolutely the hardest workers I've ever seen in my life. They make the guys from Chihuahua look like panty waist. So all that I learned from living in Mexico as a child and working with my dad behind the counter with the braceros, I put to use later on in my career. Because I was able to function very well with these workers, Mexican workers.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to, I do want to ask you about afterwards.
Sure.
But I was just wondering, did you ever see any kind of abuse of the braceros, you know, I don't know, where they weren't paid what they were supposed to, I don't know, mistreatment in any way?
I never heard of any. You had occasionally people who tried to cheat the system. They would put rocks in their
costal,
and then but they were quick to catch on to that. They would feel them, and they would find a rock, take it out. And you know, a guy like that would be fired. So it kind of worked the other way around. People were always testing the system to see where they could find a little soft spot, you know, or they would steal things in the in the store.
Oh yeah. Hmm.
They would do that. But I never saw anybody get abused. I never heard of any. Everybody wanted them to succeed in production because everybody's job depended on it. Dad couldn't sell groceries if nobody was there to pay for them.
Sure.
And so on. And so I never heard or saw of any. We heard of stuff like that. For example, you would hear stories about people in Pecos who were supposed to have had a bad reputation over there. And I personally have talked to people who told me that they had been shoved around on the sidewalk over there, you know, with these toughies, you know. But for the most part, no. There was more shenanigans going on in California, which I found out later, among the agricultural workers. But I found out that most of those were not against braceros, but against Mexican-Americans themselves, citizens, who frankly didn't have the work ethic from the guys in Mexico, and they were just trying to get by without working too hard. And they certainly did not produce what these guys did down here. The guys that were able to learn American technology did very well because they were able to join their work ethic and mastering American technology and became highly productive and well sought after and well paid. Knew more than one who became a master graftsman. You know, you have to graft a type of pecan tree onto the original pecan tree.
Sure.
The original
or
pecan tree gives very small hard nuts. But if you introduce through grafting another tree in there, then you get the large nut and you get the variety, the paper shell and so on. And so that takes some doing, but I knew one fellow who became very, very good at it, and he did it all for the Allison place. And when they introduced that as a, mm-hmm. as a cash crop, and then he became a consultant and just went to live on his own, and he would go graft for whoever hired him. And boy, his kids did well. Oh my God, they all went to college
like
in Dallas.
The most interesting occupation.
Very interesting. And then, of course, we had a lot of fellows who became masters at the tractoristas. They took great pride in that. They were very, very good at it. And so they could go to work almost anywhere where there was harvesting machinery.
Sure.
You know. And then they also became good mechanics and could move on elsewhere. And, of course, there was always the master carpenters who were always in demand. There was one or two who was always needed. And then there were guys that learned to do the welding or who were already welders. And so they brought with them a lot of skills that they put to good use. And anything to try and reach that magic status of being a resident alien, mm-hmm. the green card. That
it almost seems like there was nothing to stop you if you had the, you know, the willingness to learn to do something. There was nothing really could stop you.
That's true. And it's always good to remember that in these kinds of migrations, the fellas who finally made it over here and became braceros, went through a great deal of grief and sacrifice and doing without. It wasn't easy to get in line and get assigned and go through the process.
And be x-rayed and
checked.
Checked
and selected. And they had to prove themselves every step of the way. So the guys we had were survivors. And they're genetically, their kids were survivors too. They had a work ethic that that was incredible. And you know, I'm sure you had the information that the about what went on at the Rio Vista. Later on, I had met a friend and became friends with a fellow who was a civilian of employee of the United States Department of Health, as opposed to a commissioned officer in the same room. And this fellow was a civilian. He had a PhD in, I think I told you, entomology or etymology.
Oh, yes.
One of those. Expert in lice. Anyway, his job was to inspect them at Rio Vista. The new guys that came in, he would inspect every one of them for lice and take down the data. And he told me that you have three kinds of lice that inhabit the human body. The first one inhabits the region from your toes up to your groin, and that's their turf. They don't go any further. Then you have the second one that inhabits the body, the human body, from the groin up to the eyebrows and doesn't go any further. That's their turf. Then you have the head lice, and these are the people, these are the little insects that live in the scalp and do not come south, you know. So, yeah, that's the way it works. So anyway, he would take down notes and all that. And he would take tests on them. He would test them. And he would try and find, you know, there were different species. Anyway, interestingly enough.
Do you remember his name?
No, we called him Doc, but I don't remember his name. He was about, when I met him, he was about my age at the time, and maybe 29, 30, something like that. And he was a graduate of Rutgers, back east. And he had completed his PhD and gone to work. Anyway, for the U.S. government. Anyway, he told us that they had gone. He had been invited to go and present a paper at an annual meeting that they had regarding the Braceros program. And I think they met either in Laredo, across the river, or maybe with Monterrey, somewhere in that area. And all of the American agencies that were involved in the Bracero program on this side all had representatives down there. This would have been, you know, the Border Patrol, Customs, everybody, and certainly the United States Health Service. And they're all the guys that did the x-raying and the doctors, you know, who did the examining and all of that. They had to be free of any disease. This is where they eliminated so many people. They had TB, they had jaundice, they had, God, you name it. And they didn't want them over here because what would happen was that the Americans had to pay for health insurance. And the health insurance, for example, close to us was in Fabens. They had a doctor there, Dr. Treece, I believe, T-R-E-E-C-E, who had a little hospital there. And he also had a private practice and a partner. And they would handle what would it really amount to would be like workman's comp cases. Somebody on the farm got hurt. Somebody hit his eye or stuck something through his hand. They would immediately run him over there. And they would. They would stop what they were doing, put him in a pickup truck, and get him over there. And they would be treated. And if they needed to be admitted to the hospital, they admitted him. If not, they brought him back home and gave him stuff to take care of themselves. And they were put on light duty, just like the workman's comp. I imagine it was very similar to that. But you understand, every time a guy shows up and knocks on the emergency room for the doctor there, it's going to cost money and it's all going to accumulate. And next year, the premiums go up. So they were very careful because the farmers had a very strong lobby and they were smart. They knew what to look out for. You know, they were veterans. they had everything happen to them, working Mexican workers that you can think of. They knew all the tricks. Anyway, they get down to this meeting, and it drones on and on, and also the Mexican counterparts were there. Every state, Mexican state, had a delegation there, and these were the guys who came prepared and said, you know, we have a letter from so-and-so from who went over there to such and such a place, and this is what they did to him, and he claims that, yeah. So all of these things were ironed out. Right. That was the purpose of the thing. And then, based on what went on, the Mexican consulate, the Mexican ambassadors and all, would work up next year's requirements. By God, this year you're going to do this and that and the other. And every year, it got more expensive for the American farmers. And they were over here frantically trying to get people in California, like at UC Davis, to come up with square tomatoes that could be picked up with special equipment, you know, and all that. And of course, they were working on the machines.
Sure.
They were working on them because the cost of labor, which had been terrific in the early years of the Bracero program, now was climbing up. You know, because of the requirements from the Mexican government, who was hell-bent on having to protect their people. And incidentally, I never heard anything, none of us ever heard anything about a fund for that.
I was going to ask you about that. That was a question.
This was a surprise to me years later. I read about it in the paper because I know I never heard about it. And I would have heard about it.
And I asked Eleanor Martin about it. It's, you know, when she was paying them, did they ever take it? She said, "No, we always paid them to the penny, what they were supposed to be paid."
There was no, and she would have known because they would have been required to withhold the money and send it in with an accounting.
Exactly.
So my answer to your question, and I'm sure hers is too, is that we never heard of such a fund. Never heard of it. That it was proposed, probably. Who knows? Anyway, to go on with the story, my friend, it comes his turn. So he stands up and he brings out all his papers and he goes to the podium and he starts talking about his job. This is what he does. And he starts reading off the data and he says that he, in his findings and his inspections, he found out that the workers from, say, Michoacán, had the highest number of lice. They were the lousiest that came over. Oh my God, he said. The delegation from Michoacán jumped straight up in the air, babbled about what the hell they were doing, insulting them, and they stormed out of the room. It took a while to calm them all down and get them back, and then someone told my friend, "Don't do that anymore. Don't do that. Watch what you're saying, because these people are extremely sensitive about all that, especially that they're talking about their state. This is their people."
Sure.
So he said, "Well," he said, "of course, I was never invited back."
Yes, obviously he wasn't a diplomat.
No, he wasn't. You know. He was a good bug man. And that's as far as it went. But looking back over experience down there, I tell you, the people who stayed on and who became, even if not citizens, but accredited resident aliens, had great success with their children. And it's due to that work ethic. But again, the children's children, that third generation, they're Americans. They don't have that work ethic anymore.
They didn't see the struggles.
Oh, they never knew the struggle, so why should they?
Right. So, you were with your dad, as a teenager. How many years did you work with him there at the commissary?
I worked in the commissary off and on from 1949 till 1952 when I left to go into service. But I was asked to do other work. And my sister and a whole bunch of cousins from Tornillo were brought in at different times. Dad always had a bunch of people from Tornillo, high school students and so on, working. And sometimes there would be as many as 9.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in that smallish store. That was to handle the huge crowd. Because remember, they had to buy for 3 meals a day. No refrigeration. So in the morning they would come in and they would buy tortillas, and they begin to like the tortillas, the flour tortillas.
Mm-hmm. Harina,
which are unknown in the rest of Mexico. They all came here, you know, with corn.
The corn, sure.
And but these were much more flavorful, and they were much larger, and they grew to like them. And of course they were full of hog lard and all.
Sure. But did your father have somebody who made them for him? Do you remember?
They were made here in El Paso.
In El Paso, okay.
Oh, sure. But when they came in to unload tortillas and bread, the trucks would come in unbelievable quantities. Just Coca-Cola alone was an enormous business for us. And I'll tell you a little story about that in a minute. They liked the convenience of prepackaged food. They liked the taste of flour-based products. And they liked the convenience of canned goods. And they learned to like even canned fruit. Mm. So fresh fruit was something Dad just didn't bother with anymore. And he didn't have a whole lot of meat to sell because they didn't buy meat. They just, it was too expensive for the workers.
And but he it kept it. Probably spoiled easily, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Unless they cooked it right
away. But what they would do, of course, as you know, they'd take these beautiful steaks and then they cut them into little pieces and make stew out of them.
Yeah.
And it drives the Americans crazy.
My mother still does that.
Yeah. I love it. I love it myself. Anyway, but he always had meat, of course, for the managers and their family, because they bought there too, until they started going, driving to Fabian's and all that for better shopping variety and better prices. And Dad didn't like that either. It was a problem. But anyway, they also bought, you could see when they came in dressed in their working clothes, and then when they left months later, they had new clothes. They were heavier, and we could see them coming back year after year. And they were sturdy. They had put on weight, better color, and just by God, they looked better.
I was talking to a doctor who said that he also saw a whole demeanor. They were less, how would you say it, maybe less humble, more confident.
Yes, confidence.
More, self-confidence that he could see as well, he said.
Yes,
I can testify to the same thing. And they're great people. I really enjoyed knowing them, and I grew to learn and to appreciate their work ethic, which I keep mentioning, but it's very important. And you can see the difference between peoples in that. And they also would start bringing in their wives and become permanent acasilladas, and they would take over certain areas of the cuadra. I think the largest number they ever had was the season there. I guess it would have been about 1950-51. After that, it started going downhill, because by that time they were bringing in machines. And so you needed less labor, so there would be less people. But it still went on till, God, I don't know how long the program went on, because I left here and never came back until I came back to live in El Paso proper. But I'd went off to the service. I went for 4 years and wound up in Germany and so on. But anyway, they also had done away with acres of alfalfa. It was no longer a cash crop of any real importance, and they were not having to turn over, you know, rejuvenate the soil for cotton because there was less cotton being grown. The American cotton farmers, according to some farmers, had been, well, the State Department and the Department of Labor and Department of Commerce, they had just screwed up the Americans' market in the cotton. And people got tired of it elsewhere. And so they started growing their own cotton. Egyptian cotton became very, very good. South American cotton, Mexican cotton, everywhere. They were cotton growing climates. They started growing their own in Africa too. Mm. So the American cotton was not in such high demand. They also grew the what they call the very fine cotton, which is used to make very fine
cotton goods.
I was just going to ask you if you want to maybe just a quick little recap of, so you left to go to the military in 52, that
yes.
was I guess during the Korean.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And you spent some time, you said you ended up in Germany.
Yes.
So you were away from here for how many years?
I was away from here for 4 years. I left in 52 and came back in 56. And then I started college at UTEC, well, Texas Western College
Texas
at the
Western.
Time. And I worked part-time downtown. I went to work from the paint business. And then I eventually wound up with my own construction company. I did that for 10 years. And then I was recruited to go to California. A headhunter in Dallas got a hold of me. By that time I had developed a good experience in large roofing projects, high-rise roofing. And of course I was bilingual and bicultural, and they needed somebody in Northern California with those qualifications, which was, I couldn't believe it. What do you mean in California? Well, they paid our wage, and I went out there. Sure enough, we found out, well, there just weren't any. The guys that had big roofing experience were not bilingual and had no knowledge of how to work with these Mexican groups. And what had happened was there had been an evolution. The American unions had been in great strength in Northern California and in all of California as roofing. Was one of the specialty trades, kind of like being a plumber, you know, mm-hmm. really at the top of the heap. But their productivity was not very good. And so they had been replaced with ethnic groups. They brought in Hawaiians into
really?
Northern California.
Huh.
And their productivity was a little better. Let's say that the union guys would produce 25 squares a day of roofing. That's 2,500. 25 squares. The Hawaiians may do 30, 32. Then the all African black groups also were there, roofers, and they had a little better, more or less. And then they brought in other groups, ethnic groups. And but still in all, it was like the same thing that had happened down here with the cotton farmers. The productivity was not helping the contractors to meet the demand and be competitive. They weren't producing.
Hmm.
So they decided to try Mexicans. Mexicans had not been recruited for roofing work. They just simply weren't. They had a few of them up there who really were illegal aliens, and they were good workers, but you didn't have crews of them. You had individuals. Anyway, they decided to try them, and all of a sudden, the Mexican crews, whole crews together, either five to a crew or seven to a crew, that makes up a crew, they would come in and double.
Oh, really? Wow.
Double the production in one day and more. And they also would work overtime every day, 10, 12 hours a day. 10 or 12 hours a day. And they would work Saturdays if they wanted them. No problem. And they were doing 45, 50, 65 squares a day. Well, the contractors were overjoyed. The only problem was there was no communication. Mm-hmm. The Anglo and even the Mexican-American supervisors couldn't communicate with the Mexican people. They didn't speak Spanish, and they were not bicultural. They didn't understand them. And the Mexicans, very, very few of them even spoke a little English. So you see what was happening. So they needed somebody in this particular company that would make a bridge. So that's where I came in. And that's why it wasn't happening over there, which I couldn't believe. But anyway, we got over there, and I was supposed to stay there for 5 years. We only wound up staying for two, but we stayed on another 3 years doing other things. But we
this
had...
This was what years again? Do you remember what years this was?
Went over there in 1990, came back in 1994.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, we had a total of 100 workers from Mexico in, it was a pool of workers that were brought in from one little town in Jalisco, and they, we were going back and forth, they would fly back and forth to this little town of Jalisco. Actually, they would land in Guadalajara and then bus over, but anyway, they were there overnight. If we needed somebody, the word would go out and boom, here comes a guy, all set with his papers. Papers. I was wise to all this paperwork stuff down here, even if those people up there weren't. Anyway, the whole thing was that they just took over more and more of the work, the Mexican groups. And our particular company was the largest roofing company in California. Matter of fact, it was the largest roofing company in North America.
Really?
We did $140 million of work in 1 year.
Wow.
And they had a union group and a non-union group. So I was in the non-union group. And these union people were hysterical. They just didn't want anything to do with them. They didn't want the company to hire them. And so there was a lot of infighting. But production is production. Anyway, I had to modernize their thinking. I had to teach them about safety and all of that. So that's what I did. And my boss was originally from South Bend, Indiana, big German guy from roofing business. He had actually, he was from England. He had a green card too.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. Anyway, he never learned Spanish and had no intention of learning. And he wanted everybody to speak English to him, which we couldn't. So there was a lot of hard feelings going on all the time. And I had to, you know, I had to bridge over a lot of that. But these guys were terrific. But I knew how to talk to them. I knew how they thought. I knew how they, what they would do,
sure,
what they were capable of doing. So we got along great. And I was able to smooth over a lot of things. When I got over there, there were four outstanding lawsuits against the company. These were work comp cases where the guys had burned themselves and they hadn't really taken care of them very well. And then they had fired them. They just messed it up. And they also had what I called discrimination kickers tied into it.
So you got 25,000 lawyers in San Francisco. And they would send runners out to these guys who were collecting unemployment and approach them and say, you have an accident? Yeah. Well, look, you know, you're entitled to a lot more money.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You go see my boss, his lawyer. He'll tell you all about it. Okay. So he goes over there and talks to him.
Another lawsuit.
You bet we'll fix you right up. Well, it took me a year to help settle those four cases. What they had done is when a guy got burned, they would say, okay, here, go to the clinic. They'll take care of you. And the guy didn't speak English. He didn't know where the hell he was. He didn't even know how to take the bus and get over there. They just threw him out in the street, literally. Well, you can see what would happen.
Sure.
Anyway, nobody ever bothered to check up on the guy and see how he was doing, and in general, behave in a civilized manner toward the guy, following the rules. You know, they didn't do it. They weren't going to do it. So when I got over there, I had to stop all that. When anybody got hurt, I put them in my truck. I took them to the doctor. I sat there and went through the whole thing with them, including skin grafts and everything else. This mean hurt. You get a bunch of tar on you, it'll burn you right down to the bone. Anyway, I also would follow up on them and make sure that they would, because, you know, a bad burn will last a year before it really, they can go back to work before then, but, you know. Mm. So I knew that what they really needed was simply people to explain to them what was going to happen, that they didn't have to worry, there would be money coming in for them, and so on. And then when they were through, and they could go back to work, they had a job. That's all that was needed. So I was able to work that all that out and settle those four cases. The minimum one was for $22,000. The rest of them were a lot more. And so they had some real problems there for lack of communication. Well, we got a hold of some Mexican-Americans. One or two of them did speak Spanish, but they had no cultural knowledge of how to talk to these men. And they spoke American Spanish, kitchen Spanish.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. And so they couldn't get along with those men because they didn't really understand each other, and they sure weren't empathetic. They weren't used to it. They didn't know how to talk to them. They didn't know where these guys were coming from or anything. So that led to some problems, you know. But eventually the company, there was so much inefficiency going on, that eventually it went bankrupt.
Oh, really?
The largest building, high-rise roofing company in the United States. It went bankrupt. They had merged with another company out of Arizona, the number three company. It was then really huge. But they all had the same problem. They weren't even computerized properly.
Oh.
And they had no training, and they had no regard for the workers. And even though more and more of them were using Mexican workers, they never learned how to get along with them or what to do with them and all that. So all of that I was able to use that I had learned down here. And it worked out rather well for me. So there is something to be said, you know, on both sides. It was a gain, you know.
Well, let me just ask you one last question then.
Sure.
Anything else you... I was going to ask you if you thought the program succeeded, but I think we've pretty well established that you think it did.
I think it eventually died of its own accord, and through a combination of things. One was a change in the crop. The other was that the industry became mechanized. And second of all, the cost of importing Mexican labor on a bracero basis became as expensive as hiring Americans, because even though you had higher productivity, the cost no longer was cost efficient, you know. So it lasted for a good while, I don't know, 10, 12 years, I suppose. And it worked, and people benefited by it. And that was, by the way, the basis for the maquiladora industry. right? I'm sure you covered that in your research. So that did come from that. But I saw it from its very beginning. I didn't realize I was doing it. I remember being in a school trip in about 1949 or 50 in Chihuahua City. We had gone down there, the little school, and we had gone down to visit in Chihuahua, and we stayed at a hotel there. And in the evening, we went to eat. And out in the patio, they were surrounded by a wrought iron fence. And there were hundreds of men pressed up against the fence. They were looking for food, drink, whatever. And so some of the older guys went over and took them some food and beer and whatever. And we talked to them. They told us that they were there because Chihuahua is a gathering place for the state. Chihuahua City. For the gathering place for the state of Chihuahua for people who wanted to become braceros. So they were in there from all over the place. But they had to, on their own, they had to do the best they could. If they didn't have any money, boy, they were up against it. But you can see what they went through to finally get here. And so the guys who got here were the survivors. And that's why I say it really worked. But you have to give them credit for just refusing to give up until they got here and got what they wanted, an opportunity to make some money.
Sure. Well, anything else you want to add?
No, I think that's pretty much it. Talked your ear off here.
Okay. Well, this is the end of the interview.